oftentimes have to refer to these things in passing very quickly. Like we will mention, say, for instance, Vesco. We'll talk about Robert Vesco, and we'll talk about Mitch Werbel, and we'll just throw those names out in passing. And they won't mean a whole lot to people who have not were not around for the original broadcast where these names were introduced, or people who study them on their own. So because of this problem, and because of the fact that we had to keep going back and laboriously reiterating every single detail every time we wanted to add one new detail on the top, in other words, it's like building a new cathedral every time you want to put a new gargoyle on the roof, we decided that what we would do would prepare these archive broadcasts, and they are literally that, for the purpose of making a radio archive, a radio library in which people can hang on to these tapes. They will have the information in single subject doses. In other words, we'll only be talking about one particular area rather than ranging far and wide back across the board, because even in talking about one area, we have to range pretty far and wide. And we'll be doing these 4 hours at a time, one subject, very in-depth examinations. And, of course, as we quickly found out, some of these subjects require even more than one four-hour time slot, and we do two, three, four, even five shows occasionally. And this is the second of the broadcasts, which are probably going to be maybe even as many as four broadcasts, because they're so germane to what's going on the subject of intelligence, our intelligence and military networks in this country, and their involvement with the drug trade. Okay, so one of the very important things to realize as we start this broadcast tonight is that these things are to be taped, if at all possible. We realize it's very difficult for people to sit and listen to an entire broadcast all the way through. It's going to be 4 hours. It's going to be fascinating stuff. If you're in any way, shape, or form interested in the world around you, it's going to be very interesting stuff. There's probably a lot of things about your country that you are not aware of and about other people's countries. However, we do understand also that it is occasionally a little tough to listen to this kind of in-depth information for a long period of time. This is why we strongly recommend that that this information be taped whenever possible. However, there are also available for people who do not have access to tape players. There are also there's a tape service that we utilize that does make tapes of these broadcasts, and we will give you the address later in the broadcast where you can contact these people to get copies of these tapes, of these archive shows, if you cannot tape them yourself. But again, if you haven't tuned in before, we strongly urge you to batten down the hatches and stay with us for a while and see if you have ever heard anything like this on your radio station.
Okay, now, again, our programs are intended for use as audio reference works. There's never been a better time, as Nip indicated, to get into this kind of material. It would be, it would be more difficult to fully appreciate the broadcast we're going to be doing this evening without discussing some, at least to a certain extent, reviewing some of the major points that we covered in the first broadcast on the subject of the interrelationship between our intelligence system and the narcotics traffic. In our first broadcast, what we basically looked at was how the main elements of the international heroin trade following World War II grew directly out of the Central Intelligence Agency's Cold War policy, or really America's Cold War policy as expressed, through the actions of the Central Intelligence Agency. Specifically in this regard, what we looked at in the first broadcast was the development of the French Connection and the development of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. In each case, both of those major elements, and those are perhaps two of the three most important connections with regard to the post-war heroin trade, the other being the so-called Golden Crescent area of Southwest Asia, the Golden Triangle being in Southeast Asia, the French Connection being essentially the cooperative interrelationship between Turkish opium growers, the mafia, the Onorata Società of Sicily, and Union Chorus of Corsica. We covered the growth of the French Connection and the growth of the Golden Triangle, both stemming directly from relationships formed by the U.S. intelligence apparatus during the war, that World War II, that is, which then extended into the Cold War period. Specifically, we took a look at how during World War II, the United States began working actively with the mafia in this country in two basic capacities. First of all, the Office of Naval Intelligence formed a liaison with Lucky Luciano's East Coast Mafia organization, and in return for basically a guarantee of freedom at the end of World War II, Luciano enlisted his mafia organization as a security organization to guard against Axis saboteurs on the docks of the east coast of the United States during World War II. In addition, the mafia elements which were allied with Luciano's American mafia organization, that is the Sicilian mafia elements allied with Luciano's American mafia organization, in turn were pressed into this World War II alliance with the mafia and assisted General Patton's landings in Sicily. following the conclusion of hostilities in Europe, or at least the conclusion of the war against Nazism, the collaboration between U.S. intelligence and the Mafia was extended. This time, the Mafia was used as a bulwark against communism, and specifically, the Mafia was placed in power in Sicily in considerable measure in order to guard against the very resurgent and lively Communist Party that was active in Sicily and throughout Italy, largely because of the popular sentiment that they enjoyed as a result of their resistance against the Nazis. So the Mafia in Sicily, which had been largely wiped out by Mussolini, was basically placed into power by U.S. intelligence at the end of World War II in order to guard against the possibility of communism in Italy and Sicily. This placed the Mafia, which then the Luciano organization, Lucky Luciano, was exiled to Sicily after being released as per his agreement with naval intelligence. The Luciano organization then became the dominant element, Sicilian element, the dominant Mafia element in the post-World War II heroin trafficking. In this regard, the Mafia, the Sicilian Mafia, worked out a relationship, a cooperative relationship with the Union Corse, the Corsican syndicate, which operated largely out of Marseille on the mainland of France. Here, too, U.S. intelligence and our Cold War policies were front and center in establishing the so-called French Connection. The Union Corse, just like the Sicilian Mafia, was actively supported by the Central Intelligence Agency at the end of after World War II in order to serve as basically an anti-communist cadre. As a result of the power that the Union Corse derived, they became the dominant element in the Marseille underworld and a very, very powerful element in southern France. The Union Corse and the Marseille gangsters were notoriously effective smugglers, and because of pressure put on some of the Sicilian heroin laboratories, which were working for the Luciano organization, the Luciano organization and the Sicilian Mafia in general worked out a cooperative relationship with Union Corse, whereby Union Corse would refine the Mafia's heroin in Marseille. It was then transshipped to the United States. The point here being that the establishment of the French Connection was made possible by the power given to two organized crime syndicates by the Central Intelligence Agency, specifically in order to function as anti-communist cadres. The Sicilian Mafia in Sicily, the Union Corse in Marseille, primarily on the mainland of France, got the power that they needed in order to become the two dominant elements in the French Connection element of the international heroin trade, one of the dominant connections in the post-World War II heroin trade, as a result of the assistance they were given by U.S. intelligence after the war. Now, in Asia, we took a look again at another relationship formed during World War II by U.S. intelligence with a crime syndicate. In this case, specifically, we were taking a look at the alliance between the Office of Strategic Services and the Chiang Kai-shek security officer Tai Li, T-I-L-I. Tai Li, in turn, his organization, he was basically sort of like the security minister for Chiang Kai-shek. He was described by one observer as Chiang Kai-shek's Himmler, basically the head policeman of Chiang Kai-shek's basically fascist government in China prior to and during World War II. Now, Tai Li, in turn, made liberal use that his organization, the core of his organization, his security organization, was comprised of the Green Gang out of Shanghai, which was headed by a fellow named Tu Yue Sheng. The Green Gang was basically an organization which financed itself through the manipulation of the international opium trade. They were opium traffickers. They, in turn, became, under Tai Li, the bulk of Chiang Kai-shek's security apparatus. During World War II, U.S. intelligence actively cooperated with the Tai Li organization. Then, as the relationship between the nationalist Chinese elements and the U.S. national security establishment was extended into the post-World War II period, U.S. intelligence continued to cooperate with the dope-dealing elements of Chiang Kai-shek's organization, and CIA support for the residual Kuomintang elements in Southeast Asia after the fall of nationalist China, after Mao Zedong took control of the mainland of China, the CIA, in order to, again, combat communism, gave heavy support to the Kuomintang armies which had fled China for Southeast Asia. As we saw in Europe, the material assistance given to these Kuomintang elements permitted them to not only control but to develop far beyond what had originally been the Golden Triangle heroin traffic in Southeast Asia. This was basically the heroin which the U.S. came across during the course of our expeditionary for our invasion of South Vietnam, or during the Vietnam War. Following that, and this will take us right up to the point we're at, where we will be beginning this broadcast, we took a look at how the French, during their phase of the Indochina War, had used the opium traffic and the profits derived thereby to put together basically a security force to finance an irregular army comprised of various ethnic tribes groups, tribal groups, which were in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. Many of these groups, particularly the Hmong or Mayo tribesmen in Laos, financed their activities. They had their major cash crop was the opium poppy. The French facilitated the traffic of some of these indigenous groups and used the profits thereby to sustain an irregular army comprised of the Hmong and other tribal groups during the French phase of the Indochina War. This policy, to a considerable extent, was revived by the U.S. when we moved into the Indochina War. We took a look at how Nguyen Cao Ky, head of the Vietnamese Air Force and the vice president of the now-defunct South Vietnamese Republic, cooperated with a fellow named General Loan, L-O-A-N, and the two of them financed set up, revived, the security apparatus of Nguyen Van Thieu, which, again, was largely dependent on profits derived from the very lucrative opium trade in Saigon. Loan and Ky, with the active cooperation of U.S. officials, essentially controlled, they corralled the opium trade in Vietnam, used the proceeds from it and the graft from it to finance a security and an anti-Viet Cong security organization in Vietnam during the war. Beyond that, and again as a sort of development or refinement of the technique of using opium income to provide the financing for anti-communist cadres, the United States picked up where the French left off and began actively assisting the Mayo or Hmong tribesmen in Laos with their opium trade. Specifically, we took a look at Air America, a CIA air proprietary, and their unfortunate habit of flying opium into South Vietnam, where, in partnership with Nguyen Cao Ky, the former head of the vice marshal of the Vietnamese Air Force, vice president of the Republic under Nguyen Van Thieu, where, in partnership with General Ky and other South Vietnamese generals, the United States wound up, in essence, trafficking in opium. See, the Air America and the CIA would fly the opium grown in Laos and the Golden Triangle into Vietnam, where the South Vietnamese government, in cooperation with the United States, would then deal that very same heroin. And, of course, the main victims of the Southeast Asian heroin trade during the Vietnam War was our own GIs. The addict population of the country swelled enormously during the Vietnam War. Those addicts were being addicted by dope grown by the people we were there to protect, and those drugs were flown into Vietnam by the United States government itself. So we have a pattern, which we're going to see developing further, where the United States basically took a page from the French's, from the book of the French, and used the proceeds from the opium and heroin traffic to finance anti-communist armies and agents. And this is where we're going to begin this evening. We're going to take a look at perhaps one of the most startling and perhaps the most loathsome single development of our Southeast Asian policy, our Vietnam policy, the development of an organization called the Nguyen Han Bank, in which we're going to see a further development and a formalization of the habit of using dope financing to expedite and to underwrite political dealings.
Now, if you want to make, draw some kind of a larger allusion here to how this happened, it's fairly obvious to see that as our security forces came more and more to rely on anti-communist forces who, as Dave so aptly put it, whose primary income was oftentimes heroin or other forms of dangerous narcotics, more and more our security forces themselves, in the form of the CIA case officers and the special military intelligence people, began to find what an extremely liquid method of funding the drug traffic was. One of the reasons that drugs are such a lucrative business, besides the fact that the demand never dies off, is that because they are comparatively extremely easy to ship from one place to another. They are a very lucrative form for the amount of actual raw material that has to be moved from one place to another. In other words, there's very few other businesses where you can take something that weighs less than a pound and make hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars off of it, which you can in the drug trade. So a comparatively small amount that can be shipped rather easily and moved around by small groups of people, not needing a huge infrastructure, although those have developed. Also, in many cases, because the people involved in the drug trade, because of the illegal nature of the drug trade and because of its strong ties into the fascist anti-communist community, are also directly in contact with other people of like political minds, and there is an extremely well-organized system of drugs and guns being swapped back and forth, and money that is very difficult to trace being shot back and forth from one place to another. So as in the 1940s, late 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, the secret team of the United States, the intelligence and military establishments, began more and more to operate outside the law, outside the charter of congressional and public approval. More and more they came up against the situation so common to people who are trying to do something and not let other people find out about it, which is, where do we get the money for it? That being the case, they were forced to take the drugs, or whatever the case might be, or the weapons, and move things back and forth, and use these systems to operate essentially a black market political economy that would allow the intelligence forces, whether they be the CIA or U.S. military forces, or in the early days the OSS, would allow them with a comparatively small expensive manpower to set up a system whereby money could be kept flowing in almost continuously into a system, they would have instant access to all the things that that illegal or illicit or black market money could gain for them, namely weapons, the service of mercenaries, and illegal bases on which to plan and to train people and things of that nature. So as the CIA in particular and our intelligence forces in general began to see more and more their role in the post-World War II world, that as being sort of a vast secret police to keep the entire world controlled in one shape or form, to fight communism, to influence political destinies of countries all over the world, more and more they began to take their dealings underground to bypass the normal procedures altogether, and more these illicit forms of funding these things, coups and counter-coups, revolutionary insurgencies, etc., became the case. And drugs, because of the contacts that had been made with the Mafia and the Union Corse and the Kuomintang drug gangs, drugs became more and more the method by which this could be done.
All right, now we're going to begin a discussion with something which will pick up exactly where we left off at the the end of the last broadcast, namely the development of the technique that the CIA borrowed from the French anti-insurgency policy during the first part of the Vietnam War, the habit or the technique of using the profits derived from the dope trade to finance covert operations. Initially, the so-called secret army in Laos was financed through the dope traffic. As we're going to see, an organization called the Nguyen Han Bank, which began during the Vietnam War and which in and of itself was actually a U.S. intelligence operation, plain and simple, which was established, among other things, for the express purpose of trafficking in drugs, the Nguyen Han Bank began during this same period. And this evening, specifically, we're going to take a look at the interrelationship between the narcotics trade and the arms traffic. We're going to take a look at how the CIA moves guns for drugs.
All right. The first section that we're going to read from is from the book entitled In Banks We Trust. The author is Penny Lernoux, L-E-R-N-O-U-X, and the book was originally published in hardback by Anchor Press Doubleday in 1984. Penny Lernoux writes in Chapter 4, titled Nguyen Han Murder and the Good Old Boys of the CIA. Early on a Sunday morning in 1980, two patrolmen, driving along a lonely stretch of highway near the Australian port of Sydney, came upon a Mercedes sedan with its lights on. Inside the car, slumped across the front seat in a puddle of blood, was the body of a middle-aged man. Searching his pockets, the patrolman found the business card of William Colby, former director of the CIA. On the back of the card was the itinerary of a trip Colby intended to make to Asia. Beside the body were a new rifle and a Bible with a meat pie wrapper as a place mark. On the wrapper were scrawled the names of Colby and Congressman Bob Wilson of California, then the ranking Republican on the House Armed Services Committee. The dead man turned out to be a Sydney merchant banker named Frank Nguyen, spelled N-U-G-A-N, co-owner of the Nguyen Han Bank, and Hand, H-A-N-D. His apparent suicide set off an international scandal involving heroin and arms traffickers, the CIA, and enough high-ranking U.S. military officers to launch a small war. The Nguyen Han saga is revealing as much for what it says about banks as about the CIA, for the bank was the fulcrum of a multitude of illegal and lucrative activities, from heroin running to investment swindles, as well as paymaster for CIA covert actions against Australia's Labour Party. Skipping down. Frank Nguyen was a fast learner. A thick-set man with a flair for self-promotion, Nguyen had an ingratiating manner that could, quote, charm the pants off anybody, as one colleague recalled. The son of a Spanish migrant who had done well in the food packing business, Nguyen took a law degree at the University of California and returned to Sydney, ambitious for the open combat of the business world. The young Australian was a natural partner for Michael Hand, a tough-talking Green Beret with the Special Forces in Vietnam, who visited Australia when it was a rest and recreation center for American troops. Hand left Vietnam in 1968 to settle in Sydney, where he joined forces with Nugent to promote Australian tourism, mining, and real estate through an outfit called Australasian and Pacific Holdings Limited. The company may well have been a CIA front, since four of the original shareholders listed Air America, the CIA airline, as their address, and two other investors were from a CIA-related institution. In 1973, the pair formed the Nugent Hand Bank. It attracted depositors with offers of private banking services, the highest interest rates in the region, tax-free deposits, and complete secrecy. Within 6 years, it had 22 branches around the world. But Nugent Hand's biggest business came from laundering money for Asian and Australian heroin dealers. Not coincidentally, the bank's officers read like a who's who of the CIA. Despite CIA denials of involvement, there is strong historical evidence to support the suspicion that the bank was founded to help finance the CIA's role in Southeast Asia's heroin traffic.
Continuing. As noted by scholar Alfred W. McCoy in The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, after World War II, Washington believed that the United States was the rightful heir to Europe's Asian colonial empires. To legitimize their foreign adventures, America's Cold Warriors embraced a militant ideology that regarded all Asian nationalist struggles as pawns of international communism, unquote. The CIA became the vanguard of the anti-communist crusade. Any ally was welcome and any means justified. During the early 1950s, for example, the CIA backed the formation in Burma of a guerrilla army of nationalist Chinese who were responsible for almost a third of the world's illicit opium supply. In Laos, the CIA created a Mao mercenary army whose commander manufactured heroin for sale to American GIs in South Vietnam. And in late 1969, new heroin laboratories sprang up in the Golden Triangle, where Burma, Thailand, and Laos converge. The State Department, wrote McCoy, provides unconditional support for corrupt governments openly engaged in the drug traffic, unquote. In view of such activities, a drug bank set up by the CIA has a certain logic, particularly since a bank was obviously necessary to recycle the huge sums of money involved in the heroin traffic. Evidence uncovered by detectives and journalists also shows that Nugent Hand arranged arms deals in South America, Africa, and the Middle East, and served as financial intermediary for former CIA agent and notorious arms dealer Edwin P. Wilson. Records seized by the Australian authorities show further that the bank received lengthy reports about military and political activities, mostly in Cambodia, but also in Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. They were prepared by Nugent Hand's Bangkok representative, a former career British naval officer, and seemed to have no connection with the bank's normal business. Equally suspicious, the CIA, FBI, and U.S. Customs refused, on grounds of national security, to release information that they held on the bank's activities. When the Australian weekly The National Times petitioned under the U.S. Freedom of Information Act for FBI records, it received only 71 of 151 pages requested. Of these, most had been blacked out in heavy ink with a notation B1, unquote, meaning that disclosure would endanger U.S. national defense or foreign policy. Observed Nugent Hand liquidator John O'Brien, quote, "It has obvious overtones that somebody is covering something up," unquote. The question is whether the people who ran the bank were in it for the money or because they thought they were serving a political cause. McCoy, whose observations were made in the late 1960s, did not think the CIA was in the drug traffic to finance its clandestine operations or because of a few corrupt agents. Rather, its role was the inadvertent and inevitable consequence of its Cold War tactics, unquote. But by the mid-1970s, the Cold War hysteria had passed, and political reasons for dealing with drug traffickers seemed less compelling. So either the CIA was carrying on its own private Cold War, or Nugent Hand was an intelligence cover for crime. Frank Nugent's activities suggest the latter.
Continuing with In Banks We Trust. For an agent with a cause, Nugent engaged in some funny sidelines, such as defrauding several large insurance companies of their interest in a Nugent family fruit and vegetable business, in addition to fraudulent dealings at the bank. He also lived high. Literally, he had a bottle-a-day scotch habit, in a lavish Sydney home that he had remodeled at the cost of $500,000. the day he died, Nugent was completing negotiations for the purchase of a $2.2 million country estate, a venture that does not suggest a man about to commit suicide. Indeed, there is as much mystery surrounding Nugent's death as there is about his checkered career in banking. Though Nugent was facing criminal charges over the family food business, he seemed his charming, chipper self to the very end. In the last 6 months of his life, he had gone on the wagon, lost nearly 50 pounds on a crash diet, and taken to attending church almost daily. If the sudden changes were signs of unraveling, Nugent's associates seemed unaware of them. Hand and the other directors were taken by surprise when Nugent's body was found, as shown by an impromptu cover-up that failed to conceal the bank's illegal dealings. And when an official inquest was held, the coroner's suicide verdict was challenged on the ground that Nugent would have to have been a, quote, contortionist, to have shot himself in the head with a rifle from the position in which he was sitting. Nor were the dead man's fingerprints found on the rifle. Even after the inquest was closed, some were still unconvinced that the body in Nugent's Mercedes was really his. And in 1982, the New South Wales Attorney General ordered an exhumation of the corpse after witnesses claimed to have seen him in a bar in Atlanta, Georgia. The remains were positively identified as Nugent's by means of teeth and a webbed foot. Much of the evidence detailing Nugent's operations was destroyed by Nugent's partner, Green Beret Michael Hand, who had often boasted of working for the CIA. When he learned of Nugent's death, Hand rushed back to Sydney from a business trip in London. He was joined by the bank's president, Earl P. Buddy Yates, retired Rear Admiral and former Chief of Staff for Strategic Planning with U.S. forces in Asia and the Pacific. Hand and Yates called the bank's other directors to an emergency meeting at the bank. Among those present was Bernie Houghton, H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N, a former undercover agent who had worked with U.S. Naval Intelligence in the Pacific and was the bank's Saudi Arabian representative. According to Stephen K.A. Hill, one of the directors present at the meeting, the group shredded enough records to fill a small room. What they could not destroy, they packed in cartons and carried that night to the back room of a butcher shop owned by a former Army sergeant in Vietnam who was an associate of Houghton. Hill said that Houghton brought along his lawyer, Michael Maloney, to oversee the ransacking and that Maloney warned them, quote, "I am fully aware of what has been going on. You all face jail terms of up to 16 years. Hand then broke in to say if the Maloney's orders were not obeyed, quote, "terrible things would happen." Quote, "Your wives will be cut up and returned to you in bits and pieces," unquote.
Continuing. Meanwhile, in Manila, three-star General three-star General Leroy J. Manner, the recently retired Chief of Staff for all U.S. forces in Asia and the Pacific, was trying to persuade Nugent Hand's public relations officer to stop the wire services from reporting Nugent's death. On a secret assignment for the Air Force in the Philippines, Manner was also helping to run Nugent Hand's Manila office. Nor were Manner and Yates the only high-ranking former U.S. military and intelligence officials working for the bank. General Edwin F. Black, commander of U.S. troops in Thailand during the Vietnam War and later Assistant Army Chief of Staff for the Pacific, was president of Nugent Hand's Hawaiian operations. The consulting offices of General Earl Koch Jr., C-O-C-K-E, a retired general with the U.S. National Guard, served as Nugent Hand's Washington headquarters. On the intelligence side, Nugent Hand associates included William Colby, director of the CIA between 1973 and 6, who served as a lawyer for the bank; Walter McDonald, a former deputy director of the CIA who worked as a consultant; Guy Pauker, P-A-U-K-E-R, a CIA advisor, also a consultant; and Dale Holmgren, flight service manager for a CIA-run airline in the Far East known as Civil Air Transport, who opened Nugent Hand's Taipei branch. The bank's man in Manila was Roy Manner, a CIA consultant involved in the aborted rescue mission of American hostages in Iran. Robert Red Jansen, former CIA station chief in Bangkok, represented Nugent Hand in Thailand. Also linked to the bank were the CIA station chief of Australia and two CIA case officers. The beginnings of this star-studded assembly can be traced to the Vietnam War, which had brought together such people as Houghton and Hand. Like Hand, Houghton took up residence in Sydney, where he opened a chain of restaurants that would later play host to U.S. congressmen, CIA officials, and military brass, including Representative Wilson's Armed Services Committee. Hand had had some experience in real estate promotion as a salesman for a development project promoted by the singer Pat Boone, and financed by the American shipping magnate D.K. Ludwig. According to confidential reports obtained by the Australian Federal Bureau of Narcotics, Hand later used that landing strip constructed on the real estate development for heroin flights made from Asia to Australia by an Air America pilot. As acknowledged by U.S. drug enforcement officials, Air America figured prominently in the CIA's heroin traffic from Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle.
Continuing, the bank was also actively engaged in the drug trade. One of its principal branches was in Chiang Mai, in the heart of Thailand's poppy-growing fields. Australia's biggest drug pushers operated out of this region. They also banked with Nugan Hand. Among the bank's clients was the $100 million Mr. Asia heroin syndicate, which also arranged for the contract murders of at least three persons in Australia. Neil Evans, former head of the Chiang Mai branch, testified that during 6 months at the bank, he saw millions of drug dollars pass through the branch. He also said that Hand had told him that he had arranged for Nugan Hand to become the CIA's paymaster, quote, for disbursement of funds anywhere in the world on behalf of the CIA, and also for the taking of money on behalf of the CIA. Evans' charges confirm those of Peter Wilcox, an American energy consultant who said he met Hand in Singapore on the recommendation of General Black, himself a graduate of the CIA's wartime predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services, otherwise known as the OSS. Wilcox said that Hand and Nugan tried to recruit him for the bank with the story that he was needed for, quote, deep cover work as part of an unidentified intelligence operation. Wilcox declined the offer. Later, his military friends told him that the bank was moving, quote, unbelievable amounts of money covertly out of Australia, Indonesia, and Thailand. The bank apparently was able to carry on such operations because of highly placed contacts at the Australian Federal Bureau of Narcotics. One of the Bureau's informants worked for the bank, and he tipped off investigators. Quote, they are bigger than anything you have ever seen here in the heroin game, and are said to be part of an American security organization. If you caught these blokes, all hell would break loose. The day after these allegations, the informant found himself being tailed instead of Nugan or Hand. Within a year, it had become apparent to the investigators that Frank Nugan had direct access to Bureau information, which he often obtained within hours of its internal appearance. According to a formal Bureau, according to a former Bureau officer, quote, Nugan was getting to hear about our inquiries literally before we could even update our holdings on them. In 1978, the Bureau's director placed on file a memo suspending any further investigation into Nugan Hand. A year later, the Bureau was disbanded.
Continuing, the bank also had fruitful contacts with the Australian Security Intelligence Organization, ASIO, a secret counter-spy group that worked closely with the CIA and may have been responsible for the Narcotics Bureau's strange behavior in the Nugan Hand case. Statements by two FBI agents sent to Australia in 1982 and an ultra-secret wiretap of Frank Nugan's phone suggest that ASIO was involved in the affair. Australian immigration records also show that a senior ASIO official vouched for Nugan Hand's ubiquitous Houghton when he entered Australia in 1972 with an expired visa. On ASIO's word, he received a visa allowing him to travel and leave Australia at will. The Pentagon operates a vital base at Pine Gap in central Australia, which monitors U.S. satellites watching the USSR and China and directs the United States nuclear submarines. When the Labor Party was voted into power in 1972, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, that's G-O-U-G-H-W-H-I-T-L-A-M, quickly let me start that again. When the Labor Party was voted into power in 1972, Prime Minister Gough Whitlam quickly antagonized Washington by pulling Australian troops out of Vietnam and condemning President Nixon for the bombing of Hanoi. But nothing so enraged the CIA and ASIO as Whitlam's repeated criticisms of the Pine Gap installation. Ray Klein, former CIA Deputy Director of Intelligence, later confirmed a joint CIA-ASIO plan to destabilize the Whitlam government through misinformation and contribution to opposition politicians. The Nugan Hand Bank played an important role in the fall of Whitlam's government in November of 1975 by financing bugging and forgery operations. I'm going to repeat that last sentence again. The Nugan Hand Bank played an important role in the fall of Whitlam's government in November of 1975 by financing bugging and forgery operations. A former executive of the bank also told Inquiry magazine that under William Colby, the CIA laundered millions of dollars through Nugan Hand to support pro-U.S. political parties in Europe, allegedly including Italy's Christian Democrats. The bank was founded while William Colby was director of the CIA, and he continued to play a part in its affairs after he left the agency, including Nugan Hand's mysterious Panama branch and an attempt to take over a Florida bank.
Finishing up our segment from In Banks We Trust. In addition to drugs, Nugan Hand was involved in various arms deals with Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, Brazil, and the White Rhodesian government of Ian Smith. The bank also did business with Edwin Wilson, the former CIA agent convicted in the United States of selling explosives to Libya and charged with supplying trained men, arms, and technology to Libya and other military buyers. Memos and testimony by Nugan Hand employees show that Hand met with Wilson in Bangkok and that Houghton held discussions with him in Switzerland. Intelligence sources also claim that Houghton used Nugan Hand's Saudi Arabian branch to finance Wilson's arms smuggling operations. In view of such activities, one might ask why so many high-ranking U.S. military men lent their names and prestige to the bank. Part of the answer may lie in the U.S. intelligence community's obvious ties to Nugan Hand. While Colby and Admiral Yates denied any connection between the CIA and the bank, General Black was not so sure. Quote, "I'm not saying it's not possible," he allowed, "but I certainly wasn't aware of it." Walter McDonald, the Nugan Hand consultant and former CIA deputy director, was also uncertain. Quote, "I really don't see it happening, but I can't vouch for it," unquote. Technically, they may have been correct, since the bank apparently was originally part of a deep cover intelligence operation known as Task Force 157, which worked with the CIA but was controlled by the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence and was directly responsible to strong-willed Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. The task force gained notoriety when 21 of its former agents took the Navy to court to demand civil service benefits after the group was abruptly disbanded in 1977 because of some unknown internal scandal. Ed Wilson had a desk and his own staff at the task force's Washington headquarters and is credited with supplying the operation's front name, Pierce Morgan. Informed sources said that Task Force 157 used the Nugan Hand Bank for covert naval intelligence money, just as the CIA used it to undermine Australia's Labor government. According to the National Times of Australia, General Black figured prominently in the bank's operations, having previously been, quote, "in charge of various paramilitary operations in Asia involving a number of unorthodox financing arrangements," unquote. Well, the history of the Nugan Hand Bank, as we have all seen, is a history of unorthodox financing arrangements, and the history of the CIA's involvement of the drug trade could be summed up that same way, and rather unorthodox set of financing arrangements. Before we go back into this in depth, for those of you, again, who are just tuning in and have not heard of Radio Free America before and are curious as to why exactly we're talking about these kinds of things, the interest or the self-interest of anybody in what their government is doing is obvious, but even more so with Irangate and Countrygate going on, because as we read on one of our regular broadcasts during the week, there are allegations in the committee of Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts that the Contras were using some of the money given to them by the Reagan administration to ship upwards of a ton a week of cocaine into this country. As you will recall earlier in this article from In Banks We Trust, we were reading about one of the things that Penny Larneau was talking about was the fact that that the CIA has put together over the years a set of arrangements with these mercenary right-wing groups, anti-communist groups, and has literally funded their activities by allowing them to sell drugs unhindered to the American people. And it's entirely possible, as a matter of fact, it's more than entirely possible, it's damned likely that that's exactly what's going on with the Contras, as we have seen, and we will talk about later.
This coming Sunday, by the way, for those people who are in a position to hear this live, be tuned in, and during what is normally a phone-in talk show, we're going to be reading for 3 hours and do kind of a mini archive show about Contragate and its intersection with the National Security Establishment's arms and drugs traffic. So, again, before we go back and sort of sum up and review some of the major points of Nugan Hand, bear in mind that this bank, engaged openly in the arms traffic and the narcotics traffic, is a U.S. intelligence operation, involved large elements of CIA, also appears to have intersected heavily with a special U.S. Naval Intelligence Group, Task Force 157, effectively controlled by Henry Kissinger, involving, among others, Ed Wilson, who we've looked at in so many other programs, chiefly Radio Free America number 4. I'd like to read a story by way of reviewing the cast of characters here for the Nugenhan Bank. Here are some of the people, again, although the names were mentioned in Penny LaNew's section from In Banks We Trust, I'm going to review some of the names again that figure prominently in the Nugenhan story. This is from an article in the Wall Street Journal of August 24th, 1982. This is put together by a Wall Street Journal staff reporter. It's headlined, Admirals and Generals and Ex-CIA Men Took Prominent Roles in Nugenhan Bank at Stateline, Sydney, Australia. Enough top-ranking U.S. military and intelligence officers worked for Nugenhan to run a small-sized war. The list includes Admiral Earl Buddy Yates, a 1943 graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, Legion of Honor winner in Vietnam, and commander of the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy. Then he was the chief of staff for plans and policy of the U.S. Pacific Command, in charge of all strategic planning from California to the Persian Gulf until his retirement in July of 1974. He became the president of Nugenhan Bank early in 1977, recruited by Maurice Bernard Houghton, who apparently is an old friend. General Leroy J. Manor, M-A-N-O-R, the chief of staff for the entire Pacific Command until he retired in July of 1978 to undertake new duties that the Air Force says are so secret that it can't talk about them. These duties are generally known to have included negotiating the 1979 agreement with the Philippine government for continuance of the U.S. military bases there, which General Manor used to command, and investigating the failed hostage rescue raid in Iran in 1980, an assignment that apparently stemmed from his having designed and commanded the 1970 raid on a North Vietnamese prison camp that failed to find any U.S. prisoners. A much-decorated Air Force three-star general, he also had been the special assistant to the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon for counterinsurgency and special activities, unquote. He joined Nugenhan's Manila office, allegedly to run it, which he denies, in 1979. General Edwin F. Black, a 1940 graduate of West Point. He entered the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which later became the CIA and was the OSS commander in Berlin. He was the chief administrative aide to and frequent chess opponent of Alan Dulles, who became the head of the CIA. He was the wartime boss and then tennis partner of Richard Helms, who also became the head of the CIA. He was on the National Security Council staff under President Eisenhower, and later the commander of all U.S. troops in Thailand during the Vietnam War, before becoming Assistant Army Chief of Staff for the Pacific. He retired in 1970 to become Executive Vice President of the Freedoms Foundation in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, a group promoting conservative politics. He also worked for LTV Corporation, an important CIA contractor. In 1977, he became the president of Nugenhan Incorporated Hawaii and special representative of the overall organization, making frequent trips to Asia. He says he was recruited by Admiral Yates and another admiral. General Earl Koch Jr., C-O-C-K-E, whose entry in Who's Who in America says that during World War II, he was prisoner of war three times, actually executed, unquote, by a German firing squad and delivered the coup de grace but survived 1945. He held various posts with the Defense Department as an executive with Delta and then Peruvian Airlines. He is a former National Commander of the American Legion, Honorary Commander of the Nationalist Chinese Air Force, and holder of the French Legion of Honor and top medals from Spain, the Philippines, and Italy. Now listed as a retired general with the U.S. National Guard and a consultant. His continuing office served as Nugenhan's Washington office. His consulting office served as Nugenhan's Washington office. William Colby, the U.S. Director of Central Intelligence, 1973 through 6. He ran intelligence programs in Vietnam during the war. In 1979 and 1980, as a lawyer with the Wall Street firm of Reed and Priest, he worked for Nugenhan on a variety of matters. Tax problems, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, an abortive project to relocate Indo-Chinese refugees on an island in either the Caribbean or the Pacific, an attempt to take over a Florida bank, the operations of Nugenhan's mysterious Panama branch, and the problems surrounding Mr. Nugen's death. Mr. Colby submitted $46,000 in bills which weren't paid. A $10,000 check for his retainer was issued, but never cashed. Walter McDonald, a career CIA officer since 1975 and deputy director in charge of economic research from 1972 to 1977.